welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. My name is Matthew Dawkins, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And Eddie Webb.
Hello.
Hello, indeed. Hello. We're here for an interview. What?
A very ominous interview.
Oh, I thought that was a sound of revulsion. Coming from
you. No!
Oh. No, I was reacting
poor
to the
Chris. Fact
that you all went super low. You were all like, hello, hello indeed. And I was like, oh, what's a sexy, sinister interview?
Yeah, I thought I heard a ugh, but it may have been internal. We have an interview with the delightfully dapper Chris Allen today, and there is no ugh about it. Chris is a wonderful colleague and a new developer among us. He has worked on many different games, as we will get into in the interview. This is going to be an Eddie and Matthew job. So, Dixie,
yeah.
Where are we locking away the co-hosts these days?
The cupboard is in not good shape for locking people away. I've unfortunately wrecked that completely.
You frenzied when you were trapped in there. So
I freaked out. It was scary.
I mean, I'll just go play Pokemon Go for an hour. Like, I'll just go walk around.
Yeah, that's probably a healthier option. We don't need to lock you anywhere. We'll lock you out.
Yeah, I'll just voluntarily leave. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
Go outside and play.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, to the outside world with you. Let us jump straight into this interview with Chris Allen. And we're back with our guest, Mr. Chris Allen. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, this is the first time you've been on the Pathcast. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay, actually, yeah. We are busy with all sorts of things on some new projects, but I'm happy to take time out today.
And what new projects have those been? He asks of it as if he doesn't know.
What projects did I just give you, Chris?
So various things we're sort of cracking on with. The current one, the most recent one that's obviously taken a lot of my time, is my first proper development or co-development gig with Onyx Path on the Victorian Mage book for Mage the Ascension. But lots of other things going on as well. Kith and Kin for Changeling. Finishing up my second drafts for the first proper supplement for Eon Trinity, the new edition of that, which is Distant Worlds. And occasionally poking a few bits and pieces on another project that Matthew's familiar with, which is Solemn Veil. Just waiting to see how that pans out. Lots going on.
Let's go back in time a little then, Chris, because not everyone is going to know who you are. As you say, this new mage gig that you've picked up is your first development job for Onyx Path, but I don't believe it's the first role-playing game you've ever developed, is it?
No. Theoretically, I developed the first ever thing I wrote for a role-playing game at all, which was way, 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 way back in 2003, 2004. The heady rush of the D20 days when I wrote I wrote a product called Steam and Steel for the D20 system at the time, which was, you know, a fantasy Steam Tech kind of setup, mixing magic, Steam technology, etc. And I wrote that off my own back. It was originally meant to be a piece for a friend's e-zine, and it just kind of kept on growing from the original idea. And then I had a book, so I went to EM Publishing and pitched it to them at the time, and they then produced it and delivered it through Drive-Thru RPG. And so that was the first thing I developed, because I developed it, wrote it, did the whole thing myself. So, you know, but I have developed a number of products in a more conventional manner when I worked at Mongoose Publishing for a couple of years. And then obviously had a bit of a lull in terms of development work since then till now, partly because I was either in other industries. And then when I returned to writing for role-playing games, obviously for Onyx Path primarily, I've done quite a lot of writing over the last, 4 or 5 years. But this is, I think, the first time I've had a full, proper development role on an Onyx Path project. So I'm really excited about that.
What were you working on for Mongoose, if I may ask?
Ooh, well, so Mongoose at the time had a structure where there was a team of editors. And we'd each have our own projects we'd be working on. But as an editor, each editor wore a lot of different hats. So an editor was also doing layout on some of the books, was doing the development roles on the work, and the art direction as well, things like that. So obviously Onyx Path is structured quite a bit differently. You know, when I first started working on Onyx Path, it was interesting to see how a lot of these roles were much more split out. It wasn't that there was no one else to do them at Mongoose. It was just things were centralized. So each person was doing all those roles for their particular projects rather than there being a general art director, for example. And so obviously working there, worked on several D20 projects, including some compilations or anthologies of some of Mongoose's earlier work. And then a lot of, you know, Mongoose had a lot of licenses. So I was working on Babylon 5. I worked on Starship Troopers. Worked on some of the 2000 AD linked licenses. Some of those was developing as an editor, developing products on those lines. I also later on was working as a miniatures games designer as well. So doing a lot of design work on the miniatures games linked into those licenses. And also involved a bit on the re-release of the Thud board game with the Terry Pratchett's Thud board game that came out, which was really released when the book called Thud was released. All sorts of things when I was over there. It was quite a packed schedule of work we were going through, and very, very varied in terms of what we were dealing with. Like I said, you know, it was D20 licenses, there were board games, there were war games, there were role-playing games. So all sorts of things while I was there.
Were you on the Judge Dredd miniatures game, out of interest?
I was on a particular version of that. I was on the Gangs of Mega City 1 incarnation, which was the skirmish war games focused around the gangs. When I joined, the box set was very much heading into its final stages, so I didn't contribute very much to that, although there were a few elements in playtesting that I sort of pointed out and we made some changes. But I then wrote the supplement for it called Death on the Streets, which was like a tiny little, you know, booklet book which had crazy additions like ape gangs, robot gangs, trogs, Judge Dredd himself, all that kind of stuff in it. So I worked on this. I didn't work on the later incarnation of the Judge Dredd's miniatures game. But I did work on A Call to Arms, which was the Babylon 5 fleet miniatures game. And I worked on the Starship Troopers miniatures game as well, which was a much more conventional war game, you know, in the style of things that people think of when they think of like the GW war games. Quite a few different things there. There was so much that it's quite hard to like remember everything. I keep on thinking, there's another thing. Oh, yes, I remember working a little bit on the side of like playtesting on the Mighty Armies box sets, which was a kind of cool system where you could get your whole army in a little box. You know, it was it was a sort of an epic style scale, small, you know, lots of soldiers on each individual base kind of thing. Loads and loads of things we did there.
Whatever happened to Mongoose?
Mongoose are still around. Mongoose are still kicking around. They've refocused a bit. I believe they're still doing things like Traveller. They are still working on a war game based around naval stuff. I know that was always one of the passions of Matthew Sprange, one of the guys who ran the company. So I haven't looked too closely of late. They are still around. They're still producing. They are still there doing their stuff. I think they still sell a lot of the things from when I was there, sort of back catalog things. You know, and a lot of companies do that these days. It's much easier than it used to be because of things like PDFs and DriveThruRPG.
Right.
They still exist. They have survived.
Which, you know, for D20 era companies is actually an achievement in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many companies popping up during that time. And a lot of them were relatively fly-by-night. Even some with very big names involved would fizzle out pretty fast. And it's quite notable. And the survivors, I think a lot of the survivors from that era, companies-wise, have either... they either grew enough that they were able to survive and have become middleweight companies now, if you like, or they specialized, they sort of made their own niche. They stopped being as extensive a company as they were, and they focused on particular things that have obviously worked for a given company, you know, in the long term. But yeah, there were a lot of companies that did not survive.
Totally. And I know that I remember a Mongoose. I think a lot of why, from outside perspective, why Mongoose survived is because of those licenses. And it must have been a challenge. I've worked on a lot of licensed stuff myself. It must have been a really challenge to try to not only make sure that you're doing good content on a regular basis, but also that you're adhering to all the needs of the license holder. Did you have a lot of contact with license holders and stuff, or did you kind of send stuff away and then comes back with comments?
It varied from between license holders. A lot of the stuff that happened was at a remove from my position. Generally, mm-hmm. we were lucky, in that a lot of stuff was taken care of above our position. And then when it was coming down to the individual products that we were feeding through, it was, you know, relatively straightforward stuff. But it varied from license holder to license holder. You know, some of them would just have a quick look over and send it back, it's fine. Some of them would scrutinize mm-hmm. more closely. And they had different things they cared about. You know, some license holders
yep.
didn't really care that much about what was in the product as long as it wasn't, you know, wildly off-piste. But they would care hugely about the trade dress. You know, the logo that you would put on the back had to be in the precisely correct type of black, not just any old black, because mm-hmm. that was their trade dress, and that was what they needed, and that was what the people you were dealing with really cared about. So, it definitely varied, and some were probably easier than others to deal with.
Yeah, I remember my work on the World Wrestling Entertainment role-playing game, New Year's Roll. We like 85% of stuff went through and they were just like, yeah, sure, whatever. But they came back and they had very firm opinions about, we had to put the TM after every single person's name. And also we could not use the word wrestler anywhere. We had to use the word superstar. And it was a very challenging experience.
Yeah,
Sports entertainer, pal.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's odd as well. Cause you know, the companies we work with, you know, they're quite large. You know, Rebellion with 2000 AD, you know, Warner Brothers and things like that, and being lucky enough to work on the re-release of Terry Pratchett's Thud as well. You know, a lot of these people I work with are, yep. they are serious names, you know, they're big names, but but it didn't feel an awful lot from the editor's point of view as if you were sort of tapping into this vast global industry, really, because the communications were fairly limited, you know, focused around what was going on with that product. So it was thankfully, from my point of view, relatively free of red tape and excessive bureaucracy or anything like that. You know, it was relatively direct and simple in most cases.
Excellent.
So how did you make the, I guess, migration over to working on Onyx Path games predominantly?
Yeah, so after I created Steam and Steel, and then I worked a little bit for a company called Maladinscape Press on Etherscope, which was a D20 Victoriana steampunk game.
You could play horse human hybrids.
You had Etherscope, yeah. Really? Yeah. Obviously, Maladin's Gate is long since defunct. I then sort of parlayed that into getting into with Mongoose, worked with them for a while. But what happened after that was, for various reasons, in the following years, I didn't really have an awful lot to do with the industry. In terms of work, I was still role playing. You know, I was still gaming with my spare time.
Mm-hmm.
But I worked in a bunch of unrelated, you know, areas. So I worked for the civil service, did a lot of marketing work for private companies, and then eventually basically ran my own small publishing company, magazine publishing company, for a little while. But about 5 years ago now, what got me back in was the release of the second editions, essentially, of the game lines, and specifically Vampyre. The Requiem, obviously, as it was then, it was the Blood and Smoke Chronicle, I had always been what got me into the first editions was Werewolf of Forsaken, and then I kind of spread my wings a bit with it. I played various of the first edition game lines. When Vampyre Second Edition came out, it was really popular, at least in the communities I was frequenting online. There were a lot of changes that looked really good. You know, a friend of mine, Dave Brookshaw, who was looking at getting Mage done into the second edition at that point and all that. You know, so I talked to him about it, what was coming through. I talked to people online about it. And there was a lot to like about what had happened with the second edition of Vampyre. And being a huge fan of Werewolf, I started a thread on RPGNet, I think, which was basically like, I am going to ramble about my ideas for what could be done with Werewolf, you know. Like, what would be cool? Given looking at what's happened in Vampyre and given there's all this kind of buzz in the air for second editions, what do I think would be cool for a second edition of Werewolf? And so I started a big thread about it and I talked about it. And, you know, various people took part and we talked about ideas for what could be done with Werewolf the Forsaken. And off the back of that, I kind of ended up getting introduced online to Stu Wilson, who was the developer for, who was going to be the developer for second edition Werewolf, who was interested in some of what I had to say. So then I put in a submission through the submission system for a Werewolf of Forsaken. Yeah, I did a little piece on for a Werewolf of Forsaken appropriate bit. Stu liked it and asked me on to the writing team of Werewolf of Forsaken second edition. Now, I'll be honest, you know, a lot of the stuff, the ideas I had and things I was saying about what stuff we could do for Werewolf of Forsaken as a new version isn't anything like what Werewolf of Forsaken second edition is like, you know. Absolute credit to Stu and the rest of the development team on that. There's some great work on it. And I'm really happy with what second edition Werewolf looks like. But that was sort of what drew me in and what got me in there. And then I was invited to ask to write on other projects, a little bit by bit, and it sort of snowballed. And last year, I think it was last year, then became I had been asked to work on so many different things. Especially I think, after working on Dark Eras 1, on the Sundered World, which was quite well received by a lot of people. And then being asked to work on Dark Eras 2 last year, and getting my foot in the door with Aeon Trinity, working on the new Deviant and all that. And it sort of, it just sort of built up, I guess. And these days I have quite a lot of projects on my plate, which I'm not complaining about at all, but it's really, it hasn't been a steady increase. It's been quite rapid, I guess. And really exciting as well in along the way.
I think you are becoming known, if not already known, as one of the, I guess, experts of the Chronicles of Darkness. It does seem that you have worked across a great many of the game lines at this point, or at least have knowledge of them, and that's definitely something that stands you in good stead. And, well, from my perspective, as, I guess, an in-house developer, makes you eminently hireable. It's something not to blow your trumpet too much, Chris, but it's definitely something that any aspiring developers or up-and-coming writers should take note of, that one of the best ways of getting hired is to do the research, to get to know the games, because the more games you know, the more games you're likely to be hired on. And obviously that's come to you in the case of, as you say, Dark Eras, all these Chronicles of Darkness game lines. You've worked on Contagion for me, of course.
Yep.
And Mummy the Curse, second edition, among a host of other things. So what is it, if would you say Werewolf the Forsaken is your game? Would you say that's
your
main port?
I wouldn't dare to say something like that, because I feel like a game needs it needs multiple perspectives on it. Generally, I think, I went into Werewolf the Forsaken second edition having my very strong ideas about, you know, this is what I definitely think a new Werewolf game should look like. And then what I ran into was a team of really creative, intelligent people with a load of great ideas. And what came out of that, I think, was much stronger than I would have had, you know, going in by myself. I would certainly say that Forsaken is my first love in the Chronicles of Darkness. It is the game that got me into the Chronicles of Darkness, and it's the game I have played the most of any of them, the most consistently. And it's given me a lot of fun. It's given me a lot of great experiences. And it's certainly the one that I care for the most. I hold it most closely to my heart of all the lines. while I would say I'm certainly, you know, I'm, it's difficult. There's a lot of material for any line, and no one person can really know all of it, for sure. Even, you know, I often get blindsided by someone saying, oh, yes, but in this first edition book for Elf, there was this. And I'm like, wow, I'd completely forgotten about that. That's really good, but I'd forgotten about it.
Yeah.
And I think realistically, it's Werewolf is the game I would like to call my game, but realistically, you know, it's a group effort by a lot of very talented people, both in the first edition that feeds through to the second edition as well, you know. It's certainly the one that my dream was always to really get in on Werewolf and help shape that going forwards. And I'm really happy to be able to do that. And I'm very happy to work on all the other game lines as well. And it's fantastic spreading the experience and, you know, getting the chance to work on them as well. But, you know, if it came down to, if someone said a binary choice, a Well for the Forsaken book or another one, I would generally go for the Forsaken book because that's just where my passion really is rooted with the Chronicles of Darkness.
I imagine Eddie's very much the same with Pugmire. I'm very much the same with Vampire the Masquerade at this point. Yeah, you know, it's a comfort zone in a way, but you know, there's nothing wrong with having a favorite. And on that note, here's a quiz for you. Oh. If you had to pick three elements of Werewolf the Forsaken that really sing to you, the three strongest components of that game that you immediately think of and you immediately use to sell the game to someone else, what would those three be?
Well, that's pretty simple for me. Body horror, dark animism, the pack. The pack is one of the ones that always really appealed to me from the beginning because, you know, I imagine most people, some of us have been very lucky with the groups we've gamed with, but you know, most we've played different games, different genres with groups, and the pack in Forsaken is one of those things I love because it immediately puts everyone on the same page. You're all part of the pack, and what that means is you are all on the same side. And a pack doesn't have to be a harmonious family. Families can be really filled with strife, but it's that idea that at the end of the day, you've got each other's backs. And the pack in the setup deals with so many issues. A lot of games, when you set them up and you go, how did everyone come together in this adventuring party? Or why are you all doing the same thing? And sometimes you encounter situations where it's quite hard to just say, yeah, really, my character should probably just give the rest of you the burden, leave, shouldn't they? Because I've, you know, and that can happen entirely accidentally as well. Not everyone should be building characters that work towards the group goal, but it happens that, you know, you make a mistake and you end up in those kind of situations. And the pack element, everyone's got each other's backs, loyalty, working together has provided some great game experiences for me, made it a lot easier to run in some cases, and because it's such a different underlying assumption to a lot of role-playing games about the unit of people that you've brought together, I found it provides an experience that I really enjoy and my players really enjoy as well. Body horror is, so I'm a bit of a contradiction on this. I love body horror, but I visually hate it. I am incredibly squeamish. I am an absolute coward watching gory films and things, but somehow in a role-playing game or written is a completely different deal. And I love the body horror in Werewolf. You know, it was one of the foremost of the Chronicles of Darkness games that really does that thing, you know, the violence, the horror, the grotesquerie. But the fact it also matches it with a streak of paranoia, which I really love in the games, which is the thing about, you know, is this old friend of yours looking at you with their eyes or with the eyes of a spider that's nestled in their brain? You know, is this person who they say they are, or is something just wearing them like a skin? The shape-shifting elements, the paranoia all feeds into that, and I found Werewolf is a fantastic game for that. The way it matches the brutal physicality of werewolves, but actually gives you a whole load of tools as a storyteller for how to make a great story that isn't just some werewolves punch some guys and tear them apart, and there's all that horror to it and all the physicality still, but it's not simply solve everything by, you know, hammer to nail approach. And finally for me, dark animism. I love the shadow in Forsaken. It was one of the things that really roped me in very early on, was this idea of this alien other world that is intrinsically linked to the real world, yet totally different, familiar and yet strange at the same time. The weird capering eldritch entities of the shadow, their strange relationships to one another, how they interact back and forth, how they're shaped by the real world and how they shape it in turn. It's, for me, it's one of the most compelling other worlds I've ever come across in any role-playing game. And that hooked me in really at the beginning. It grabbed me and dragged me in and sort of never really let me go. So for me, those are the three points that sort of just hit me for Werewolf, really dragged me in very early on and kept me there, really.
And here's a little bit of a tangent, but you're going to be running some Werewolf the Forsaken at the UK Games Expo this year,
aren't
you?
Yes, I am. We are going to do... am I okay to say about the general premises of the setup we're doing?
Yeah, please. Please feel free.
So we're going to do a series of games at the UK Games Expo for different lines, myself and some other people, some other freelance writers and so forth. And I'm going to run the Werewolf one. The exact details of which, you know, I haven't nailed down yet in terms of what the scenario is going to be, but the idea is that each game will then feed someone forward, feed one of the players through to a final game, which is going to be run by Matthew, which is going to be a Contagion Chronicle game. So it'll bring together one character from each of these different these different feed-in lines. So there might be, you know, one vampire, one werewolf, one sin eater or whatnot, into the Contagion Chronicle get together and then scenario, which, as I said, Matthew will run. And there's going to be prizes, I believe, as well.
Yeah, who would have thought it? Competitive role playing. Well, not so much competitive, but the idea is, and it's something we can't take full credit for. Chaosium have been doing this for a while at UK Games Expo with Call of Cthulhu across multiple eras. As Chris describes it, lots of Chronicles of Darkness games, one player and their character from each feeding through to Contagion Chronicle. Everyone that feeds through will have been voted as most entertaining by the other players on their table, and with a storyteller breaking a tie. And they all win a prize just for getting through to the Contagion Chronicle game, and then the person who is voted most entertaining on the Contagion Chronicle table gets an even bigger prize. But it's a good way to both build some excitement for these games, and also, frankly, it's decent marketing. You know, it's something Chaosium have done to fantastic effect. It's something we are looking to do as well. And it's going to be fantastic to start seeing the UK Games Expo RPG events pages just filled with Onyx Path games. That's going to be a wonderful thing to see.
Yeah, sounds really exciting, actually.
Yeah, it's not the end.
And of course, you'll be there as well.
Oh, is Eddie there?
Well, yeah, we're still working on details, but yeah, I'm going to try to be there.
Oh, exciting. Yeah, I'm running a few other things as well. It looks like I'm probably going to run some Scion games. So I'm looking forward to seeing, like, say, a load of Onyx Path games in the roster. I'm a little bit anxious because I've played in convention games before, but I've never run one before at a convention.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to be getting fraught by all the horror stories you hear online. But, so who knows how it's going to go. But, it's the first time I'm going to be running one at a convention. To be fair, until the Games Expo again, I haven't been to many conventions for quite a few years. I used to go to Gen Con UK back in the day. And I went to a few bars at Mongoose, but then there was a big gap. Apart from occasionally dropping into the Birmingham British Games Expo, I hadn't been to many. I went to the Games Expo last year, and that was really good. I'm really looking forward to going again and to running these games and seeing people again. To be honest, it's got a really good atmosphere. At least it did last year. I was really impressed by the Games Expo. So high expectations, but I'm definitely looking forward to it again this year.
Did you ever attend when the expo was being held at the old Masonic Lodge?
The previous time I went to where it is now, I can't remember exactly where it was, but it was much smaller. I don't think it was a Masonic Lodge. I think it was simply a smaller, sports center kind of setup or communal hall setup. It was definitely a fraction of its new size. I mean, it's really quite something now. I wasn't really what to expect coming in. I had a vision in my mind of something more like it used to be, and then I went in and the sort of sea of people and all these all these stalls, and it was definitely quite something, but a lot of fun. And the Games Expo seems to have really gone from strength to strength in my limited view of it, having only been a few times. It's really grown and become something much more. Obviously, a lot of it seems to be focused on, it's very broad. So it's board games and war games and things like that, as well as, you know, role-playing game companies. But a lot of the role-playing stuff is still there, and I look forward to participating in it this year properly.
Well, it's been my experience running games that if you're a person who worked on a product, I've really found the tables are a lot more laid back. It's like, oh, hey, this is the person who wrote the game we're playing, whatever. So it feels like I can get combative, it feels like I can argue with you. And generally, it's been a pleasant experience. Yeah. So I think you don't have anything to worry about.
So on the subject of, well, we've spoke about Wealth of Forsaken in quite some depth, and as I also mentioned, you are quite well known for being the one of the Chronicles of Darkness guys who knows a great swathe of the game. So how did it feel for your first Onyx Path development gig to be Mage of the Ascension?
Yeah, it was a bit of a left turn. and on top of that, obviously, I've been brought into it when the project is, you know, it's underway already. So, I brought on for administrative reasons a co-developer to drop off because they had so much other stuff they needed to do. So I came on to see something that's it's already underway, you know. The outline's already been sorted. Everything's sort of steaming along, apart from a few areas that needed, you know, some extra work on, admin elements and things like that. Which is interesting because on the one hand, the basis is already there. I'm not sort of staring at blank emptiness, wondering what I'm supposed to do. There's a functional right. project. It's ticking over. People largely know what they need doing. And obviously, as you say, it's not Chronicles of Darkness game. It's a classic World of Darkness game. Like I say, it was unexpected but welcome. My experience with Mage of the Ascension really principally comes from the M20, from the 20th anniversary lines. In the old days, back when I did play what you know the World of Darkness, what we can now call the classic World of Darkness lines, my experience was principally limited to Vampire the Masquerade, and then obviously when I started really getting into the Chronicles of Darkness, that was I remember playing Bloodlines, the computer game. Which was a bit of an odd jump, but to do Mage now is it's odd, but it's good. And the reason it's good is because it's something that it's a game I like, but I have I suppose what's the right phrase? It's good to have a little bit of distance, perhaps, to it. To be able to look at it objectively, to come in and say, right, I'm here to help get everything going along here. This project's already undergoing. I'm here to help make everything happen. And I'm not sort of too close to the text almost. You know, one problem I have, there's a little thing with Forsaken that is quite funny, is that I think, well, if I thought about developing Forsaken, of course I'd love to develop Forsaken. I'd love to you know, direct the outline of how a book would go. But I really like writing for Forsaken as well. One nice thing with the Mage Ascension, I don't feel like jealous of what the writers are writing. I don't feel like, oh, but I wish I could write that bit. Right. You know, there's no sort of, I'm not feeling territorial about that at all, and I'm looking at it from a slightly more distance and learning about it as I go along as well in areas that I hadn't maybe looked at so closely until now, but I'm now digging into because it's needed for a setting like this. But there's a few things that translate across regardless. You know, I'm a historian by training from university, and the dark eras for Chronicles of Darkness are great for that. But the same is true as this Victorian era setting is something I feel I can bring my knowledge and my skills to a bit. And some things are, as I said, some things translate across regardless of the game line. You know, they're as true for Victorian Mage of the Ascension as they are for Victorian anything else. But the fun part is then how you bring the two together. How you get them to interface and how you build a product that is not only at the end of the day, it's not only a good product. It's not only one that really takes the history and does interesting things with it, but also, you know, in today's for today's audience is something that is appropriate for them that they will enjoy. You know, so we're looking quite closely at things like imperialism and colonialism in the Victorian era. This isn't a book about, how fantastic the British Empire was and all the mages are in corsets and monocles and going, what ho, you know, it looks at the reality of the world that you are then putting the Ascension setting into. You know, colonialism in this era isn't just about an upper class of British aristocracy. It's about so much more. It's about the people in the empire and beyond it of all castes, of all classes, and their experiences with colonialism and their clashes with it. Their resistance to it, and then looking at how that then interconnects with Mage of the Ascension itself, and sort of how the setting and the game can come together to give a kind of fresh look at things. So it isn't just, oh, it's Mage of the Ascension, but we've changed the coat of paint on the top. It's something that is both Mage of the Ascension, but also different fundamentally because of the time, because of the era it's in.
Absolutely.
No, and I should... After you, Eddie.
I'll say it's like I can certainly sympathize with that kind of distance you talk about, because I had the privilege to work with Steve Kenson and Ian Watson on Aberrant as a developer, and they deeply know that setting. But I was kind of like you're talking about, you know, able to get and go, okay, well, cool, but coming at it as someone who doesn't really know all the setting, I wanted just a fun comic book style game. Does it deliver that? And so I was able to kind of weigh in and tweak a few things here and there without pushing too much. I mean, they did a great job, but I was able to kind of think, okay, from an outside perspective, how does this work? It sounds like you're going to the same approach. Like, okay, I don't, you don't know the mage stuff as in depth as some of the other people involved, but you know, you can say, okay, but how does this pair to what you do know about history, and how does that make both of those resonate better?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, and at the same time, it is Mage the Ascension, you know, and we've got a lot of very talented writers on it, and we've got people who really, really, really know their stuff. And I think a certain element is knowing when to, you know, when to really acknowledge that as well and go, this writer, this person absolutely knows their stuff here. This is very much Mage the Ascension, and, you know, respecting that.
Right.
Well, I shouldn't do a disservice and say that this is your first Onyx Path development gig, because the sheer amount of help that yourself and Leith Shields gave me on Shunned by the Moon for Werewolf the Forsaken, it was staggering, to the point that I've given you both, you know, co-developer credits, because without your knowledge, the amount of input you put in after final drafts, through text alone, as well as massaging and adjusting other people's work at my request, and writers, if you're listening, no need to panic, it's all for the better. It has been truly appreciated. And on the subject of Shunned by the Moon, because that is a book that is powering along towards release, art is, I think it's the last few pieces of art that we're expecting at time of recording. What can you tell the listeners about Shunned?
Yeah, well, Shunned is, well, as we've, I think we've said in various places, it's a night horrors book. So you kind of know what you're getting with a night horrors book. You are getting a catalogue of creatures, antagonists, people, characters, personalities to drop into your game or to add to a game to help shape a game around, give you both examples and simply, you know, straight up, you know, things you can just use as they are. I think that Shunned is a little bit different though, because it's very much being the, it's very much serving at the moment as the bestiary for Werewolf of the Forsaken. It's still following the usual night horrors format, but it's got a lot of extra material in there. You know, we've got sample pure, but we've also got the extra stuff to make the pure a more interesting antagonist game in Forsaken games in general. We've got their affinity gifts, we've got new merits and rights. It's introducing the proper rules for Balehounds and for wounds. It's introducing more backstory and details about the hitherto otherwise only very briefly touched on void spirits and what the shadow might look like beyond Luna's orbit. And it's also talking about things like the Gerio, the very new antagonist type that stemmed originally from the Contagion Chronicle. So it's absolutely packed to the gills. It's so packed to the gills that basically we kind of had to just stop writing and adding new things in because it was getting a bit ridiculous. because as Matthew Fullwell knows, if I was allowed to, I would have just kept on writing and just packing more and more things in. But there comes a point with a book where you kind of have to go, right, what is actually in the scope of this one book? Let's not go totally crazy here. So I'm really excited about it because it's got so much different stuff in it. It really is.
Yeah, and I'm quite a fan of that approach of, as a developer, one thing I do with books, if I've assigned myself any word count on them, quite often I won't write that word count until after everyone else has written theirs. I like to plug gaps with my word count, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And what we were able to do with Shunned by the Moon, with some of the new antagonists that we threw in, or visits to old friends and enemies that we haven't seen since first edition in any great detail, was great fun. It was a book with, I guess, a couple of additional stages in its development process that we don't often see, but I think it was all for the good. Because without it, we probably wouldn't be seeing Void Spirits. We wouldn't be seeing an array of human antagonists in there either. There was quite a lot of stuff we added at the back end and then sort of smoothed it out to fit it in with everything else. But I'm really looking forward to seeing how that one lands, because I'm proud of the content that yourself, Leith, and all the other writers added to that book. It's a magnificent piece of work, I think. So on to other Chronicles of Darkness. We've got another book that's coming out. We only recently did an interview with Eric about this, Eric Zawadzki. But I know that you have had a significant part in the writing of Deviant. So I guess that it's going to be partly the same thing that draws you to Deviant, that draws you to Werewolf. But let's do those same three questions again. What are the three elements of Deviant the Renegades that draw you in as a writer and, I guess, a potential player and storyteller of that game?
So yeah, I think for one of me is one of them for me is openness in terms of what you can do with it. There's the body horror elements again. Yeah, absolutely for me. And sort of drawing out an element of that. There is the paranoia. There is the that sort of element. It's a bit in games like in Werewolf with the paranoia of other people, and there's a bit in games like Demon with the espionage element.
Yeah.
There's that sense of adversariality, and you are not the stronger power here. It's you are not on your home turf kind of thing. So it's, I mean, starting with the obvious one is the freedom. Deviant really does hit a whole load of tropes and concepts that I remember, you know, David and Eric talking about back earlier, was that there are so many things in horror films and the like that didn't really slot nicely into any of the lines, the existing lines, because they didn't have that communal theme. You know, you have things like The Fly, you have things like Tetsuo the Iron Man, all these weird things that sort of work around the edges, and that Deviant brings in, and you can do any of these kind of things. Obviously, within the framework that Deviant provides, it's not completely a free-for-all. It's giving you a setting within which there is a reason why these things work the way they do. But it's potentially very, very flexible. And not just in terms of creating your character, not just in terms of creating, are you a cyborg? Have you got ancient relics stitched in place of your heart? Have you got seven people's minds jammed in your head together? But the antagonist as well, the fact that you look at creating the conspiracies, custom building conspiracies, if you don't want to use the ones in the sample settings in the book, to suit individually potentially your deviants, the guys who made your character's life a nightmare, the ones who made them, the ones who broke them. And that's really interesting for me, that level of you know, the Chronicles of Darkness games have always been said they're a toolbox. You know, they're
right.
Something for a storyteller to really make of what they want. But this is particularly true in Deviant, because, and it extends beyond the storyteller, extends to the players as well. Your decisions when you start a game of Deviant, when you start a Chronicle of Deviant, include how powerful are your guys, you know, how many variations do they sport, so how powerful, but it comes with a cost. And that affects, in turn, the kind of power of the conspiracies that are initially involved. So for me, it's exciting because there is that level of openness. You know, I wrote a lot portions of the setting, the general setting conceptual chapter, and you know, we really go into there things like you can have so many different things creating a deviant. You know, there was a concern early on, I know people asking on forums, is it all going to be science-based stuff to create them? And the answer is no. You can have deviants made by occult things going wrong or right. You can have deviants with super science. You can have deviants with supernatural elements sort of following the same kind of concepts as in the other lines. Mm-hmm. You can have deviants created more or less by inexplicable accident, and all these things can kind of go in. So the freedom with it is really quite extensive. The body horror element is there. It doesn't have to be body horror per se, but there is that element of something done to you that isn't inside your complete control anymore.
Right.
You know, the game's powers come with a cost. things can go more wrong. You know, your character can become more unstable. They can begin to generate more variations and scars upon themselves. They can change and twist in ways that may well end up being under your power as a player, but obviously aren't under the character's control. So there's that element of trying to find, the character's trying to find peace and find balance with themselves, and the manifestations of things going out of balance are quite direct. They may not be physical mutations, but they're very impactful in the world, you know. And then the paranoia element, it's right there in the concept. You are a renegade. You are generally, you know, the core assumption is you are a deviant who is out for vengeance, or who is out to survive, or who's otherwise antagonistic to the conspiracies coming after them.
Right.
It's you and those people who are on your side, and deviants tend to see things in the you know, those who are for you and those who are against you kind of worldview. So you've got that element of who can you trust. You're moving through a society where the conspiracies probably have a lot more influence than you do. They have a lot more reach than you do. So what can you do? What do you risk doing to get away with? What do you risk doing to hit back? The game features this in a lot of its mechanics, in the way scars and variations work, and in the way merits and things work as well, with the idea of so subtle and overt actions. You know, running around, flashing too much cash, pulling in too many influential contacts can itself risk you in the same way as, you know, letting loose with fire in the middle of a street can if certain conspiracies are watching for that kind of thing when they're coming after you.
Oh, another place you've explored Deviant is with the Contagion Chronicle, of course, which,
yes.
As of the time this podcast goes up, I think the Contagion Chronicle will be launching in the week following. That's the plan. So maybe you could tell some of the listeners a little about what you've written for the Contagion Chronicle.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to cross it over with something else I wrote for Deviant as well in the core book, because Eric told me I could talk about it, and I'm very keen to. I'm quite pleased because I wrote for some of the sections in the vectors in the Contagion Chronicle, but the sample location was, if I'm okay to say, is Chile in South America, which I wrote with John Burke. And this one focuses on, it has some other supernaturals involved, but it's focused on Deviant. And the conspiracy that we created for Chile, the Tierra Amarillo, are quite a fun one for me, but they're also quite a heavyweight. They're quite a hefty conspiracy. These guys are not your, you know, meddlers accidentally creating deviants. They are a significant force that any deviants in Chile are going to have to go up against and have a real hard time evading their watch for various reasons. Mm-hmm. And the chapter is both about the influence of this deviant conspiracy, whose whole thing is that they are trying to go toe to toe with a bunch of the supernatural creatures of the world of the Chronicles of Darkness. You know, this is a fundamentally originally mortal conspiracy, human conspiracy, baseline conspiracy, who are trying to bootstrap themselves up to the ability to say to all these other creatures running around going, no, this is our turf. And then obviously what happens when the contagion not so much gets involved as gets out of control and spreads from the heart of this and you know, turns everything horrible and cancerous, as it were, metaphorically speaking. I also wrote for Deviant's Core, one of the sample settings, which is in Ankara in Turkey. And that setting is, again, it involves, you know, each of the settings has a different approach to conspiracies and renegades that it's pitching. And Ankara is about having two heavyweight conspiracies duking it out, and what it means for them, and what it means for the location, and what it means for the renegades, you know, scurrying for cover or trying to strike back at these conspiracies. Ankara is a fantastically weird place because it's this, it's a new city in many ways. You know, it sprang up to prominence when it was made the capital of the new Republic of Turkey. And its urban sprawl is really weird. In real life, it's got all sorts of weird stuff because areas of the new urban construction weren't planned properly. It's filled with almost little glitches. You know, you'll come to places that make no sense, staircases that go nowhere, roads that you can't get onto in the first place. Oddities like that just have happened organically, which is perfect fodder for then making it a weird location in the Chronicles of Darkness.
Absolutely.
I mean, its name is... Ankara means anchor. It's 200 miles from a coastline. The name makes no sense. It's got the area has all these associations with the occult and alchemical stuff. Things like King Midas, and King Midas in turn has things like turning things to gold, but also association with animal features and all sorts of other things you can draw in. So it's this really weird place. It's perfect to the location, and obviously in the modern day, the clash of secularism and religion, the rise of nationalist power, right. All the elements of the real world, which obviously we have to be careful about handling sensitively, but again make it a very interesting location, and then pitching two conspiracies, both woven, both taking elements of the region's past as their basis. You know, one ancient conspiracy which digs into one of my favorite bits of real world mythology that no one knows about, called the Onycus, which is a fantastic thing in its own right. And the other one being a much more modern, you know, black ops, rogue governmental kind of stuff, and how they are trying to duke it out. And you can compare and contrast it to Chile, where you've got a load of these, again, a heavyweight conspiracy. And I think the two put next to each other provide quite a good contrast of how these things can go when conspiracies are large, when they are powerful, when they are influential mm-hmm. to some extent. And I'm really looking forward to seeing both those getting in people's hands. Both Chile with its crazy contagion related stuff, and Ankara with its sheer weirdness going on.
It sounds really cool.
Yeah, you do have an effective way of selling people on things, Chris.
I want to play it now.
Beforehand I couldn't give a talk.
Right, exactly. Yeah. No,
I vaguely recall it. No, both you and Eric so Deviant was a game I knew very little about until really listening to the interview with Eric, and everyone who I've spoken to about it since has really amped me up for that game. And when you're working with games so often, it can be quite easy to become a bit blasé about upcoming releases yeah. because you're so focused on your own work. And so I'm excited that there's a game that makes me feel excited. Mm. And I can tell from the way you're talking about it, the way Eric talks about it, and the rest of the writers, that there's a lot of pride that's gone into Deviant the Renegades. And, you know, there's a secret part of me that's not terribly secret right now that is quite proud that the first exposure people are going to be getting to Deviant in, I guess, fully written form is via the Contagion Chronicle Kickstarter, because we have an entire Deviant the Renegades chapter in that book.
Mm-hmm.
And that will basically be everyone's potential playable preview of Deviant. So that's quite a lot of fun for me.
Mm.
On the subject of Contagion, and then we'll probably have to say goodbye, you worked on the Vectors, as you mentioned.
Yep.
Now, we've not really gone into Vectors much on this podcast. So I guess at a high level, what are they, and how do they apply to the Contagion Chronicle?
So, correct me if I'm wrong, because obviously things may have changed since the draft or through development, but Vectors are really about the collected tricks, the bag of tricks that a particular group of the Sworn or the False has gathered together and sort of amalgamated, really.
Yep.
I can't remember the exact definitions, but it's sort of that thing of you have a whole bunch of supernaturals working together around core concepts, and this is kind of what's come together out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't quite sit within any one group's power set as such. You know, they're not a direct equivalent to Elf Gifts or Mage Arcana. They're specific sets of powers that reflect what that Sworn faction is about, and the kind of jury-rigged communal effort they've managed to put together of bringing their tricks, bringing their understandings, bringing their secrets together and sort of creating something new from it. And then there's the Sworn, the False Vector, in terms of how they've approached it and what that involves. So do you want me to talk about maybe one of the ones that I specifically wrote at all or anything?
Yeah, please do. Yeah. Please go ahead.
So I wrote a chunk for the Thessian, the Chip of Theseus, and I wrote the Vectors for the Rosetta Society, I think is the name. I'm trying to remember, make sure I get it right. Was it?
Yeah, you are correct.
And the Rosetta Society, it's all about it's called Semiotics, and it's about communication and symbolism. And as such, you know, each power, as you go down the chain, the powers require more, require multiple people to be working together. You know, they stop being just the effort of one person, one sworn. They start becoming a group effort. But they're about meddling with that. They're about translation and confusion. They're about understanding and imposing understanding on the world. The Rosetta ones are quite, are mostly quite sort of, what's the word, conceptual. You know, some of the powers, some of the Sworn have quite physical, brutal, direct capabilities, and the Rosetta ones are a bit more intellectual. But they are very interesting to me as a power set because of what we did starting out when obviously, I don't know who it was that actually decided on the original structure, whether it's yourself, Matthew, or someone else. But the idea that every power in a vector has slight changes to how it works according to the type of entity using it.
Right.
So a deviant using one power will get a different bonus, possibly to a werewolf. And sets of different creatures will get a particular bonus because it's appropriate, and sometimes it will be very individual. And then the specializations associated with particular factions among the main lines, not the Sworn. So you might have a power that the Circle of the Crone get an extra bonus with. And for me, that was a lot of fun to work with because we got to add all sorts of fiddly little fun bits that hooked onto elements of the main game lines that really stood out for them. That you went, they should totally have something cool relating to this because it's their shtick, you know. And I really like the fact as well that there's no concern with vectors about like, oh, why should I bother buying this power? I've already got a power like it, you know, in my native power set, because generally, they're variants on how things work. They often sidestep any particular, you know, problems that a creature may have. So mages obviously have a lot of power with the Arcana, but a vector is still useful because, among other things, it's not going to provoke any problems with paradox or that kind of thing. And the fact that they are, again, I'm not sure what it looks like in the final version, but the idea that they are group funded, as it were, you're buying them for the group rather than the individual. You're getting that buy-in. So you're not there going, oh, do I spend my XP on this power to get the next one in the chain, but it's not one that's very useful for me. There's no problem like that for the group. It's coming off that separate kind of flow of experiences. So I really like the vector design because it works fairly effectively as a cross-line power set without trying to be better than any line at a thing so that everyone feels compelled to get it. You know, you're not going to have people going, oh, the Rosetta powers are the ultimate mental skill powers, so of course I want to get them. They're not, but they do a bunch of interesting things. And they have a lot of tweaks and small bonuses for the individual lines so that you feel that there's a good reason for you to have it. Even if it's not a complete powerhouse, it may still be useful, it may be interesting, and it feeds in very strongly to how the Sworn faction feels about the Contagion and how they deal with it. Mm-hmm. So, I'm my favourite on that front are the false vectors, which obviously, you know, we did as a group effort. I know, Eddie, you did a couple of them, didn't you?
Yep.
I did a couple of them, and the third writer did the other one. And they're horrible. They're really horrible. And I love it. Because it really works to differentiate the Sworn from the false. In a way that I don't know, it just really works for me, the vectors and the SWAT and the false ones in particular, because they're just you can see why the false would use them, and mm-hmm. you can see the appeal of them, but they're just not nice. They really no, aren't.
They're not here to make friends. That's very clear.
Just for clarity and full credit, that third writer on False Vectors was Megan Fitzgerald, of course, known superstar.
I didn't realise.
Well, and not to avoid credit where it's due as well, John Kennedy contributed to the Sworn Vectors before illness had to take him away. Mm-hmm. But it was, as you said, it was definitely a group effort, which is appropriate. for the powers, because, like you say, the genesis of those powers was through... So I had a discussion with Rose. We were talking about how... Rose Bailey. We were talking about how would these work best, crossover powers. How do we do them without making the book just a big book of powers? And ultimately, I came up with something shaped a little like what we ended up with, but then I had the discussion with Eddie, and it very much got refined. The things that we kept were those specializations and edges, the idea that the power is uniform, it's just a single power, but werewolves, deviants, and Prometheans might use the power this way and have this bonus, and whereas vampires and changelings use it this way and have this modifier, and so on. And then you have your edge cases, which are, as you say, Circle of the Crone, get this additional power on top. And I guess if I had my way, my my dream project would be to be able to expand those vectors considerably, so that we could really explore how different covenants, different clans, different tribes, different orders, and so on, use each of those powers. But it would have to be quite an interesting... It would be quite an interesting book to create, because you wouldn't want it to just be dry power after power after power. It needs to be interspersed with something else.
That's why I think... Oh yes, stretch goals for that. That's also why I think the current vectors do work very well. Is they're not dry; they're quite compact. In terms of there's a look, because we had to fit so much stuff in with all the different edges and specializations, but they're not dry. They feel quite flavorsome to me. They feel like they, because you had five powers in a vector, and you're trying to really condense everything about that sworn faction into it that you can sort of think of into that power set. They came out really. It feels to me, and obviously we'll see how it all works out in the but it really felt to me that the Sworn felt fundamentally different, even though we're talking about five powers, which in the grand scope of the Chronicles of Darkness is not a lot. But those five powers for each Sworn faction, for me, made them feel quite distinct. And in a way, I think it might have been the fact that we were working so that we weren't constrained to a single line's power set. We were able to be that a bit more free, you know, a bit more spinning the wheels a bit wildly, and come up with some really interesting stuff across those powers. So I am two thumbs up for vectors. I had a lot of fun working on those, and I'm really looking forward to people getting to grips with them and seeing what they think of them.
Oh, right. We might hire you again.
Have I said enough things to get hired again, Mr. Dawkins?
Yes.
Well, and on that note, we must say goodbye to whoever this was.
Some guy.
Now, thank you very much for your time, Chris. And before you go, is there anything you want to spend your last couple of minutes plugging, or would you just like to tell people how to follow you on social media, if indeed you want people following you?
Sure. So I guess the things I would say plugging is buy Shunned by the Moon when it comes out, because I want there to be lots more Forsaken books. So please buy Shunned. I'm not desperate at all. plugging, I'll plug Solemn Veil, Mark Kelly's British folk horror RPG that I don't know when it's going to go to Kickstarter, but that will be impending, I think, which was a lot of fun to write on, which is a sort of more narrative, really narrative-heavy role-playing game we've been working on recently. It's hard because I've got so much stuff in the pipeline with Onyx Path. I don't know what to plug. There's so many things coming through, you know, Dark Eras 2, The Contagion Chronicle, Eon Trinity. Buy all of it. It's great. So social media, this is going to be fun. So yes, follow me on Twitter. I'm at Acrozatarim, which always drives people mad when they try and figure out how to spell it. So that is my one social media following, primary social media following point. I'm on the Discord channels and things like that as well, but I'm Acrozatarim on Twitter. If you can figure out how to spell it, then you've won the right to follow me, and I look forward to seeing you there.
All right, well, thank you very much for your time, Chris.
Thank you.
And we're back. Chris Allen, we have sent on his merry way off on the ice floe to meet his ancestors.
I caught so many Pokemon outside, you guys.
Did you catch a Ditto?
So many. I'm never going to catch a freaking Ditto. I'm never going to complete that quest. I'm never going to do it. Never going to catch a Ditto ever in my whole life. I can catch freaking Flower Eevees and Flower Pikachus and stuff. I can't catch a freaking Ditto. Okay, sorry. It was my Pokemon Go rant.
I've still never really got into Pokemon Go. I know I don't have to. I know it's not obliged by the state, but
yeah, kind of is.
Yeah. But the my peers in this industry do all seem to enjoy it, and I feel like I'm out of the loop somewhat. But at the same time, I don't really want to commit to filling up a catalogue.
Here's the difference between me and you, Matthew, and that's that you actually seem to enjoy physical activity, whereas I have to gamify it. I'm like, I can walk several miles if I'm playing a game, but you just tell me to walk around several miles, I'm going to be like, nah. And I'm going to go sit in my chair.
Maybe so. It is difficult to play Pokemon in the swimming pool, although one would assume that is where you find water Pokemon. See, I don't even know their damn name. Squirtle, there you go. I still know the original. When I first found out about Pokemon, it was still called Pocket Monsters.
Wow.
So it wasn't ever actually really called Pocket Monsters, but when I was at secondary school, there were a couple of boys who would get in import games for their Game Boys, and so they had somehow purchased, because of course this was before the internet, they had somehow purchased Pokemon Red and Blue, and at the time they were calling it Pocket Monsters Red and Blue. Couldn't understand a damn word of what was going on, but the mechanics of it are simple enough that, you know, anyone can get it.
Right.
And I think they had some like fan-made reference cards to tell them what Pokemon did. It was that wonderful golden age where you would look up magazines to find out cheats and guides for your games.
Really funny because that seems so long ago, but I also very clearly remember doing that for several games. Like, my mom and I had all of the like guides to various things that showed you all the secret stuff you could get for like Super Mario World, Yoshi's Island, like all the SNES games, and then we also had them for Tomorrow Later PlayStation games. And so, like, with Pokemon, it's weird because, like, I didn't get into it until about 3 or 4 years ago. Like, as an adult, I got into the 3DS versions, and then I got into Pokemon Go when it came out just because it was a fun thing that all my friends did together. And I mean, even we were at the bar, like, sometimes we would, you know, leave our drinks for a minute and walk down to the gym and battle it and then come back. Like, it was just fun.
Yeah, it's the same thing as because my family, they all got into it. And so they would say, hey, we're going to go drive down to this gym thing. And like, I have no idea what those words mean because we're sitting in a parking lot and you're looking at your phones. So eventually I was just like, well, I just want to do the same thing with my family and be part of that. But then I started playing also the 3DS games as well. So yeah, I also came into it very, very late.
Yeah. It has taken me months, but I got my boyfriend into it this past weekend. And now he walks around in bliss.
Good.
And I'm like, yay.
So he'll probably catch a Ditto before you.
Probably.
I remember hearing there was a character in it called Giovanni, and so I thought, oh, this might appeal to me, but it wasn't the same.
The same.
Well, I mean, thank God, because if the Giovanni in Pokemon was anything like the Giovanni in Vampire, those poor Pokemon. But anyway.
There are lots of bats, which are all my favorites, obviously.
Yeah, I'm guessing there's like ghost Pokemon, are there?
Yes.
We are fast forgetting. Sorry, Chris. Chris was our guest on this episode. I wonder what he thinks of Pokemon. Too late, he's gone. We can't ask him.
You didn't ask me about Pokemon? Ugh.
What's his combat power? That's my question.
I leave for one episode. And y'all would like to ask our guests about Pokemon Go. I don't understand. This podcast is ruined. I'm leaving.
Shut it all down. We're done.
Well, on that note, we will wind down, wrap up, and pack our bags and close the doors. If they want to find you on social media, Dixie, providing you haven't left the world entire, where would they go?
They find me on Twitter and on forums and everything else as Dixie Cyanide. And if they would let you share just your trainer name and not your trainer codes, that's also my trainer name. Pokemon Go.
And Eddie?
Lovely. Thank you. You can find me on Twitter at Eddie Fate, EDUIFATE. That's also my website. You can find me on Facebook at Eddie Web Writer, and you can find all my professional stuff at pugsteady.com. And also, as some people have asked me this recently, if you want just Pugmire stuff, you could find all of that at realmsofpugmire.com.
And if you want to find me, I am all over the place, a splattered, gory mess. On MatthewDawkins.com, I am on Patreon as Matthew Dawkins, I am on the Onyx Path Forum as The Gentleman Gamer, I'm on YouTube as The Gentleman Gamer, I'm on the Onyx Path YouTube channel, I'm on Twitter as Clack Click Bang. You cannot escape me. And thank you very much for listening. Many worlds, one podcast.